The legacy financial system has arrived. On January 10th, numerous Bitcoin ETFs were approved. But is this even a good thing? What does this signal for the legitimacy of Bitcoin as an asset? What does it mean for the sovereignty of the network? This could both bring trillions of dollars in liquidity into Bitcoin and break through the average person's Overton window, making Bitcoin finally seem, quote, real to many who refused to pay attention before. But the big question, the real risk, is if we cannot scale sovereignty in Bitcoin to everyone in the world, what if we just end up with gold 2.0? In a world of unbacked Bitcoin paper and no way out. It's time for a Guy's Take episode. Are the ETFs the end of the Bitcoin dream? What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And this show is brought to you by CoinKite and Swan Bitcoin. That is CoinKite, the makers of the Cold Card hardware wallet, and Swan Bitcoin, where you can smash buy, set up an auto DCA, automatic withdrawal, straight to your Cold Card, straight to your cold storage solution, and learn just about everything you need to know about plugging your life into Bitcoin. Discounts and links are in the show notes. But today, we are talking about ETFs. Mostly because I have been hearing a lot about how the ETFs and paper Bitcoin, are we going down the same road? Is Bitcoin going to become gold 2.0? Is it inevitable that if we cannot scale Bitcoin on-chain, is it not inevitable that we end up in a future where everyone is only using paper Bitcoin and the mechanism to withdraw simply doesn't exist such that there's just not enough liquidity to do it and the price is dominated and ultimately entirely controlled by the paper Bitcoin markets? And so in unpacking that, there's actually a lot of different effects and things that I want to talk about around the ETFs and what I think it means for the concept of Bitcoin's network, for where we are in adoption cycles, and what this largely means for global liquidity and access, and whether and how much of a good or a bad thing that is. Now, I highly encourage you to go listen to Alan Farrington, the episode where we read Alan Farrington's piece, and then the following guy's take of Trust Me, Bro, because it is a really fantastic piece about the ETFs, and I stand by also my general opinion or position about the ETFs, as I mentioned in that show, that it would be better for Bitcoin in the medium to long run if the ETFs did not get approved, and we had to build entirely outside of the system for another few years. It would be better for it in the short to medium term, potentially negative somewhere in the medium term, if they all got approved. But that's what should happen. The worst case scenario would be if only one or two, if only BlackRock got approved or something like that. But I just want to kind of go through what has happened and all of the kind of hilarious fiasco that went leading up to this. So first, my big indication that they were going to be approved was the fact that the SEC account and a lot of the official accounts and Gary Gensler as well, both posted about how don't trade crypto, don't buy crypto, it's volatile, it's scary, you know, you don't know what you're doing, it's dangerous, it's used by criminals. And that sounded like a defense. In the sense that they were prepping, it's like, you know, your terms of service or your disclaimer at the beginning. By the way, you know, if you go on this ride, you're going to be decapitated. Sign right here that you're okay with that. And then you get on the ride and it's a normal roller coaster. It was their liability. It's their defense mechanism for being like, okay, we're going to approve this thing, but we think you shouldn't buy this, you stupid rubes. But there's only so much we can do about it at this point. We're covering our asses. That is what that sounded like to me. The wording of it was just very, let me make sure I'm not going to get blamed for this. And their hands have largely been tied, or they've been forced to basically take this position or to basically approve it by the courts, because GPTC won in a court case to say that Gary Gensler and the SEC in general were unfairly singling this out, and all of the context of their rules and what they're supposed to be doing did not leave them any grounds to deny it because of the nature of, like, all of the things that they have, you know, proved in their due diligence, whatever. I don't know a lot of specifics about the case. I just know that they won it, and it was just showing that the SEC was being unfair in it, and they didn't actually have any grounds to deny the ETF based on what they said. At this point, it largely doesn't matter because they all got approved, and it did what it was intending to get done. So then as we got closer to the deadline, which, by the way, this wasn't the deadline for all of them. There was actually a link that someone sent to me, and I very much appreciate it. I wish I had thought to bring that up, but it was a link to all of the different ETF proposals and applications and when their deadlines were. And, you know, a lot of them have, you know, the next deadline, and then there's the final deadline, and they were basically cascaded from January 10th all the way into like May or June or something. Specifically on January 10th, the reason this is when they got approved is because the ARK Bitwise ETF had the final deadline on January 10th. And what happens essentially is if they don't specifically deny the proposal, then it's approved by default. So they have to make a statement about it on the 10th. And the reason they approved all of them at once, even though the next ones were like February, you know, there's like four or five had deadlines in February and then some in March, et cetera, I think they just didn't want an unfair advantage just out of, you know, when these things were proposed. And after they've, you know, worked and clarified all the details, there's no reason to not approve them all of them that like meet their supposed criteria at the same time. So it was just kind of like a big sweeping, fine, you can all play, but you suck and nobody should buy this, but here it is. Here's the funny thing, though. So everybody's anticipating all of this event, like whether or not this was going to get approved. And, you know, the market runs up leading into this news. Classic, very classic, buy the rumor, sell the news. But the day before, the SEC Twitter account, the official SEC Twitter account, posted a tweet that said, quote, "Today, the SEC grants approval," this was on the 9th, "grants approval for Bitcoin ETFs for listing on all registered national securities exchanges. The approved Bitcoin ETFs will be subject to ongoing surveillance and compliance measures to ensure continued investor protection. And then it had an image with Gary Gensler's face on it, as if it's a quote or whatever, and it says, "Today's approval enhances market transparency and provides investors with efficient access to digital asset investments within a regulated framework." That was the whole tweet. That was posted at 3:11 in the afternoon on the official SEC Gov account. Then at 3:26, so 15 minutes later, Gary Gensler posted specifically that the SEC Gov Twitter account was compromised and an unauthorized tweet was posted. "The SEC has not approved the listing and trading of spot Bitcoin exchange traded products." And when that happened, Bitcoin shot up from about 45 to 46,000 up to 48,000. Then subsequently turned back around and crashed back to about the 45-ish thousand. And then there was a tweet by Matt Korva that said, so they said compromised and unauthorized, but it seems like a little bit later, I can't find the tweet right now, but Elon Musk actually chimed in during this conversation, because basically nobody believed that they got hacked and then suddenly like incredibly fast when almost no one gets their account back fast if they get hacked. Incredibly fast, they had recovered access to the account and were deleting tweets and fixing things. Now, I can believe that there's like a direct line for some official accounts or government, like actual government agency accounts, and that they could probably get access back a little bit faster. But that's still a bit questionable. But Elon supposedly verified that they did actually lose access to the account, and it was because of access to a SIM swap from some employee. But the wording of the original, like, it's been compromised, an unauthorized post, I don't know, that seemed a little bit official in the sense of the legalese of not saying hacked because you weren't hacked. It sounded to me, my first impression at least, was that the announcement got accidentally announced early. Because if it was a troll, if somebody literally hacked, got access through an employee, and then posted the post, they did a good job. They did a good troll. It sounds very official. It has that, the image and everything. It's all, it sounds exactly like the legalese crap that they would post, which makes me wonder if it could be either an inside job in the sense that somebody at the SEC posted it too early, or it was scheduled on the wrong day or something, or somebody was specifically breaking into the account to manipulate the market, that they had access or they knew how to get access and they're trying to make money on a trade. I don't know. I don't think we have any concrete details really outside of Elon Musk's supposed confirmation that it was accessed through a phone number and that they did not have two-factor on the account. But Matt Corva made a tweet that I thought was hilarious and incredibly, incredibly relevant to the SEC's arrogance, maybe, or the holier-than-thou attitude that they're going to be the ones that protect everyone, and they need to tell us how to keep this information safe and how to keep the Bitcoin safe and how to make sure the ETF is secure. While Matt Corva pointed out that, quote, reminder that the agency that cannot keep its Twitter account safe wants all of your trading information. That is a pretty great point. And this is an inherent problem, just in general, when you think about it. It's very logically follows from the larger, more centralized regulatory apparatus it is. But just from the nature of bureaucratic regulatory apparatuses that, and in the idea of lifetime bureaucrats, people who just end up in the political sphere and they never do anything productive. They never actually do anything for the economy. Like, there was a reason this country was set up that it was supposed to be like a volunteer service. Like, there weren't huge paychecks for everybody who sat down in all the representatives. There was never supposed to be a bureaucratic class. But anyway, the inherent problem here is that centralized bureaucracy, those regulators, are inevitably going to end up deciding all of the rules of stuff they don't even begin to understand. And when you don't understand something, inevitably, because the larger and more responsibility it has, and the more fine-grained, the more like explicit, like point by point or project by project nanny state dictates that they want to say this can happen and this can't happen and this is how you should do this, the more depth that they go into, the least likely that they will actually have anything, any strong tendency towards actually adding positive value or coherent rule sets, and the more likely that they are going to be captured, because the ignorant are easy to control. And so the people in the industry, the biggest lobbyists, always end up controlling what goes through the bureaucracy, because it's this big centralized thing that inherently cannot actually understand or have any hands-on practical experience. Like, I would never, the SEC would be the last possible group of people among the bottom of the bucket of who I would go to for key management or how to have a reliable, verifiable proof of reserves. And to understand the risks and value of a Bitcoin investment and whether or not it even makes sense in a portfolio. That would never think that they would have anything positive to add on any of those points. They don't know anything about key management. They don't understand that the paper markets and the leveraged debt of the fiat system isn't going to work on Bitcoin. And they have no idea what it's valuable, why it's valuable. They think it's just digital points out of thin air, but is also somehow valuable for criminals and terrorists. Which is ironic that most of them believe kind of both of these at the same time, because they are mutually exclusive. If it's useful for criminals and terrorists, then it does something real. It does something that cannot be provided by anything else if what they claim is true, which means that it's not completely out of thin air. It's not valueless. So even their general basic premise for how to think about this is contradictory. Ignorant bureaucrats and ignorant politicians are easy to control because the people who do know what's going on, without them, they just look like fools. So that's why they make friends in the industries. They know the CEOs of the things because they don't know what the hell's going on. They have to ask them. And so inevitably, the entire regulatory and bureaucratic apparatus just goes to reinforcing whatever is best for the wealthiest, lobbyist, and largest, most influential corporate entities. It's so funny how backwards it always is from the normal thought process that you have to have a strong centralized government and strong centralized regulation in order to keep a company in check, the big bad corporations in check, when literally all you did was just like highly, highly centralize and paint the biggest, fattest, easiest target on the way to screw everybody for that, just on a silver platter for that big giant corporation. You think that big giant corporation doesn't have more control over those regulators than you do? Why would a regulator ever care what you think? They're not. You don't do anything. You don't take them out to dinner. You don't meet with them. Whether or not they know you has nothing to do. Like, nobody gives a crap whether Gary Gensler knows Guy Swan. Now, nobody's like, oh, he doesn't know Guy? Well, jeez, I guess I shouldn't listen to him. They have no incentive. They have nothing in front of them. There's no reach for status to do anything for the average nobody. If it ever turns out that way, it's simply because a handful of decent people made it into a bad system or totally by happenstance. If you just keep throwing a lot of darts at the wall, eventually something's going to stick. But going back to the kind of idea that they're trying to keep all of our trading history and that every single one of these things, these huge and ridiculous, expansive surveillance systems and apparati, is how unbelievably risky this doing this over and over again in so many different places is and how much danger it puts the consumer in to do nothing. You think money laundering and terrorist financing and all of this crap has somehow just plummeted since the last 10 to 15 years of being able to see everything that everybody does? Or do you think that corruption, control, and censorship has gone up? Seriously, which one? What can we really say has been the consequence of the Patriot Act and the incredible splintering tree and branches of all the surveillance apparatus and systems that have spawned from that grossly unconstitutional nonsense, along with the surveillance capitalism that it has both incentivized and essentially subsidized directly, really? Did terrorism suddenly vanish? Have we finally solved the problem of all the big bad criminals? Are all the bad people now behind bars? Or has it basically been the same, or maybe even kind of gotten worse? I mean, really, if we've been doing this and we've seen the incredible consequences to the sovereignty, the safety, and the privacy of the people, I would really like to see the data on how it's fixed everything, especially before we talk about making it any worse. But anyway, all that mess unfolded. They ended up getting approved the next day anyway. And rather than approving just the Bitwise or, you know, they just the entire lot of, I don't even know, there were like 10 of them or something. I don't know, 8 maybe. I don't know. Who cares? They're ETFs. a bunch of people made some. Then funny enough, the price kind of hovered for about a day and then plummeted today. Well, plummeted in the sense that it's very, very normal 6% swings. It took one down. So no, it didn't plummet. It just basically continued to do as Bitcoin has done for a while. But this is a big deal. This is a big deal. And it's not a big deal for a reason a lot of the people think. And it is a bad thing in a vague sense for the idea of the ideal of this being a perfectly sovereign network where everybody holds their own keys. And I think any kind of honest person, like really thinking about it, that was never really going to be the case. Like that is a fairy tale of no one is going to be using a custodian. And in fact, you don't even entirely want that. Like that's not even necessarily, you want that when there is no trust, but you actually want trusted relationships to exist. That's the basis of the market economy, is trusted relationships. What you need is a trustless means to exit and protect yourself when that trust breaks down. But hell, if trust breaks down between everyone at all, across all spheres and across all scales all at once, we're talking about the end of society. There's always going to be trust. The whole point of a trustless, independent monetary good is so that we can build trust and we can continue to ensure and enforce trust. But frankly put, a world without it is a terrible place. So it's neither the disaster that people seem to think, nor is it the loss of the underlying principle. But even if we're just talking about in the context of like Mt. Gox and FTX and, you know, Three Arrows Capital and these things, what it does do is it enables the scale of these deleveraging events. It enables the scale of the paper Bitcoin to be at a greater, quote-unquote, level of insolvency. So it's not really a good either. At least it's not a good in the fundamental sense of, or the technical sense of the solvency and or insolvency of the economy built on top of Bitcoin. That which touches paper Bitcoin is going to be at greater risk than that which has on-chain exit and on-chain volume. That is a legitimate risk, and it is a legitimate point of discussion, but it is also not really any special. The ETF isn't like super special in the context of comparing it to FTX balances. They largely run the same risk, or the same type of risk, the same kind of risk. I think the big concern would be the amount of value liquidity. Not necessarily the number of payments and or individuals in one or the other, but the amount of value that can move, that is moved or is settled on chain versus in paper. And that's where I think there is one critical difference that I think at least Bitcoin cannot become gold 2.0. It can and probably will step down in the ability to provide its assurances to the entirety of the world. I think it was always not possible. They are at odds in one way or the other, whether at the broadcast layer of the network where it simply can't scale and you lose the assurances fundamentally, systemically in the network, or you layer it up and you lose the assurances through a series of trade-offs. And you re-achieve or refocus those trade-offs where they are most important through a series of iterative improvements, which is where you have things like Lightning Network, Fediment, CTV, supposedly, and or hopefully, and we're going to be doing an episode on that. Actually, somebody shared it in the Audionauts about an article by Shinobi, who is wonderful at breaking down a lot of these technical things. I think that was Michael Matliff, actually. Shout out. What's up, man? We will be covering that this coming week, but I think there is at least one, actually, really two critical differences. There are some similarities between Bitcoin and gold when we talk about Bitcoin in full blocks and really high fees, but it is not the same. It's not the same at all. There are a handful of characteristics that lead to gold becoming nothing but paper and essentially not providing any of the sound monetary assurances that are necessary to have a sustained, balanced economy. And while Bitcoin with extremely high fees, you know, $200, $500, $1,000 fees or something, and we're only, you know, 3% of the world or 5% of the world at any one time can go to their own UTXO in, you know, some span of months and with a couple of different scaling solutions, there are at least two extremely critical differences as to why it will not end up like gold. And what I think it means is I think that where there are continue to be debt cycles, where there continue to be these imbalances between paper currency, paper Bitcoin and actual Bitcoin, and the custodied world versus the settled world, I think it's very possible that we go through a series of, essentially, it cannot grow to the scale of the problem of gold, but it will still likely recur. And what's funny is we've already seen it. That is exactly what Mt. Gox was. That was exactly what FTX, Luna, Three Arrows Capital, Genesis, that's exactly what all of these things were. They were paper money insolvencies that grew beyond and created a leveraging and thus deleveraging event alongside the Bitcoin, the actual Bitcoin assurances. We already know what it looks like when most of the capital ends up in paper Bitcoin for a short span of time. And understand, the reason it unraveled isn't because everyone went back to chain. It's because the necessary amount of value was able to exit back on chain. So I'll explain what those differences are in just a minute. But I do want to talk about what the ETFs are good or their positive benefits from the context of the network. And it's not a technical network here. We're talking about the social network of Bitcoin. Because the legitimacy, the acceptance, the apparent realness of Bitcoin for a lot of the economy is going to change a lot over the next 6 months to a year. And this is largely a massive signal of the acceptance that Bitcoin is here and it is part of the actual monetary ecosystem. It's not this thing that they can ignore. It's off in its own Bitcoin land where everybody's crazy and everybody just does stupid, weird things on the internet. It is now everywhere. It is now a thing. It's in the world. It matters. It exists. And it is plugged in to the fiat system, to the fiat architecture. This will put it inside the Overton window of a whole hell of a lot of people who, as of yet, have only ever seen it as outside of their little world, outside of their bubble of existence. And I actually think probably not in the short term, maybe not even in the medium term, but I actually think this sort of mental framing shift is actually more likely to have some sort of a meaningful effect on merchant adoption. Because I think it was It was Parker Lewis who either wrote a piece or maybe one of his talks, it was his BitBlock Boom talk, talking about how the decision to adopt Bitcoin as payments is actually a balance sheet decision. And what I think the ETFs are going to do is destigmatize having some allocation to Bitcoin. And for all the people who don't have the slightest clue what it means to actually be sovereign or to hold your own keys and don't understand even the concept of the fact that they don't own the things in their retirement account, that these are all entirely permissioned things, they're going to see this as security. They're going to see this as like a confident, approved, traditionally secured asset. Not that the price isn't going to be volatile, but this is the quote-unquote official way to buy it. There are so many people still stuck in the mindset that something isn't real or that they're not allowed to do something until they explicitly have permission or some supposed authority, someone who has the know and, you know, is in the right position, can tell me to do it or signals that it's cool to do now. For better or worse, there are a ton of those people in this world. And I think in the medium term, 1 year, 2 years, the ETFs are essentially a signal, a social signal, that this is acceptable now. This is a real asset in the quote-unquote real world, which is so ironic that what they think of as real is explicitly all of that which is provably insolvent, provably fake. So just so bizarre when you think about it from the other side of the fence. But I think once it's destigmatized socially and from the concept of having some sort of allocation to it, well, then the idea of accepting it as a merchant, I think, is just a much smaller leap. Like, the big hurdle is getting them to think that they should be touching it at all. But the big question is if the liquidity flows, if a massive amount of liquidity flows into an explicitly paper Bitcoin instrument, does this mean that Bitcoin is destined to have the same fate as gold? A fun idea that you can do with your cold card hardware wallet is they have a duress pin and a brick me pin. These are the kind of extra, like, one step further security features that you're going to find on something like the cold card that you won't find on other hardware wallets. So the duress pin is a pin that lets you open up a front-facing wallet, so to speak. The pin itself generates an entirely different wallet, but it will behave in exactly the same. There will be no apparent change whatsoever with the cold card itself. So if you're being threatened, you can punch this in and just put a small amount of Bitcoin in it, just plausible enough that that is your wallet. If you're being threatened, to let them think they got something without them accessing your cold storage. Then another great one is the brick me pin. If it's not obvious, if you punch this pin in, it will completely wipe everything on the device. It'll be completely useless. So if somebody demands your pin or steals your hardware wallet, and you just so happen to conveniently have a pin written on the inside of the case, and when they try it, it just wipes the device and keeps your coins safe from any attacker. And these are just kind of like the extra fun features that the cold card hardware wallet has. It really is just an awesome Bitcoin security device. And you should go check it out, as well as all of these cool features, at bitcoinaudible.com/coldcard. And if you use the code BitcoinAudible, you will get 9% off at checkout. Lucky for you, all of this will be saved right in the show notes, so you don't have to remember it. You just have to go right into the description and find it conveniently waiting for you. So that is the big question. Is, does this go right back to gold if it costs $200 or whatever to actually own a UTXO on chain, to go back to the base layer? Do we end up in a world where everyone is just using paper Bitcoin and things simply cannot be settled quick enough to unravel the insolvencies? Because think about it, that's what the issue is that the difference in settlement time and settlement cost between gold and paper gold and the monetary substitutes that are being used in its place, everything is so deeply and, like, massive amounts of liquidity integrated with the money substitute, and then there is almost no integration and no liquidity within the actual physical gold itself. That huge difference, that huge asymmetry, is why the debts and the leverage simply cannot be cleared out. Or more importantly, or more specifically, it's not that they can't be cleared out. It's that they are only cleared out after it reaches a scale that is so great that it matches the difference or the cost of the asymmetry between the settlement. And not just that, like, oh, it means it's going to get big enough that people will withdraw in gold. That's not what I mean. I mean that it will get big enough that the relative cost and troubles of withdrawing or removing that much money from within the system, whether it's redeeming it in gold or in putting it in housing or putting it in real estate or moving from one country to another, all of the various exits that all have insanely high costs, because gold just becomes one of the exits when the means of getting out of the system, when it's permissioned like it is, when it's closed like it is, when you have to have a license to even move, to have access to the back end, to even use the SWIFT system, when the units themselves are entirely a product of an authority saying they exist and they literally do not exist otherwise, when all of it is credit, when all of it is dependent upon the promise of someone else. exiting from that system is insanely difficult and costly. I mean, think about doing anything without being in the financial system, without using actual, even cash. If you have $2 million, how difficult is it to deal with cash? How can you even get that much cash out these days? But even if you could, it's not fun or easy. And that's not even exiting from it. That's just exiting from the payment rails. But you're still trapped in the money. Our system has become so deeply, like inception sort of substitutes of substitutes of substitutes that we think of as cash, as like this more secure and more real version of it. When really cash was the problem. Cash was the substitute that replaced gold. So this incredible asymmetry is what leads the insolvency and the leveraging events to get as bad as they are before things finally start to unravel or debts begin to clear or there is enough pressure within the system to actually push things out of the cracks and the valves and the holes in the circuit, so to speak, that otherwise are too costly, clunky, or frustrating to use, but only when the pressure is so bad that you have to save yourself, that it's literally lose everything or, you know, keep 30% of it, that finally everything starts squeezing through those exits. So if the whole world cannot get onto Bitcoin, cannot get onto on-chain with a new UTXO and completely sovereignly in a short span of time, let's say within 5 months, then doesn't this mean that we're all just going to be, we're going to have substitutes, we're going to have custodians, and we're going to be trapped in the permission financial system and, you know, that same hierarchy of authority, and ultimately that Bitcoin becomes the same thing as gold? No, I really do not think it does. And this isn't some like pie in the sky, we're going to do it different this time. This isn't an argument that Bitcoin culture is going to be ever vigilant. We're going to know that this is a stupid thing to do, or that the fiat world won't try to sell Bitcoin paper backed by nothing. And my reason assumes that we all end up largely in custodians and Bitcoin substitutes. But I still think it ends up being a world of difference. There will still be deleveraging events. There will still be broader insolvencies, but they will necessarily happen at a smaller scale. And I'll explain why I think that. I think it lies in very specifically understanding why gold failed, rather than thinking that it's just, oh, we replace gold with a substitute, we replace Bitcoin with a substitute, equals, this is the same thing. Gold's great failure wasn't that it was simply costly to settle. It wasn't simply that, oh, it was going to, you know, charge you, it was going to cost $100, or you had to go, you know, to the bank and go get your physical gold, and that costs more than just getting your paper notes. It failed because it was physical. It failed because the difference in settlement, in time, and most importantly, scale of value between a physical asset and a virtual asset is just massive. It's staggeringly different, and it scales worse. Understand, so settling $100 worth of gold is easier than settling $1 billion worth of gold. Like, on the margin, it is easier, because you can just go to the bank and stick it in your pocket. It's just a coin. But that cost continues to increase more and more and more the higher the amount of value that is being moved when it comes to physical assets, when it comes to a physical good. And then the settlement time, considering the distance, virtual, when it gets higher versus smaller, is actually kind of the opposite again. Moving $1 from the US to the UK is difficult and relatively expensive when compared to whatever the fee is. I mean, it's going to cost you more. Practically, you can't really do that outside of maybe some, you know, substitute on top of a substitute on top of a substitute with some fintech thing that just happens to have really well integrated markets in both of those areas. That's basically the extent to which that's even possible. And you would have to be in the same closed network to pull it off. But if you have $1 billion and you're trying to move it, you actually have a few more options, or you have a higher degree of assurance and reliability that it's going to happen because you can use a Swift system. You're going to use a wire, and it makes a whole lot more sense in the context of the cost that, you know, you pay a little bit more for the wire, and you're not paying like 6% or 10% of the fee or 10% of the amount in the fee. You're paying a comparatively tiny fee in relation to the amount of money being moved. And what's funny is that all of the barriers there are fake barriers. They're walled garden barriers. They're authority barriers. They are permission barriers. They don't actually exist digitally. Well, I mean, they do exist in the virtual space because it is all virtual, but I mean it in the sense that they don't physically exist. They don't actually exist in the context that if they are removed, there's nothing preventing that virtual good from actually getting there from a existential idea. From like, it's not axiomatic that that is there. Like if a bank in the, like let's say the UK and the US had the same laws, there's nothing about that physical distance that says that I can't send $1 billion virtually. It is explicitly because the UK and the US have different laws, different banking systems. They're fake boundaries. They're virtual boundaries. So they could just as easily not be there as they could actually be present and cause problems or delays. Now think about moving $1 billion of gold. It practically never happens for a good reason. It's a nightmare. And the longer the distance, the greater the cost, the greater the settlement time delay, and the greater the risk in the scale of that settlement. So if you have an institution that's holding $1 trillion and 800 billion of that is fake, they're actually insolvent. They only actually have $200 billion worth of settlement value. How the hell do you clear that $200 billion to call their bluff? How do you get that out of the system? And if it's actually wrapped up in the entire system, if that imbalance is actually cross institutions, then you can't even just withdraw it to a different institution within the ACH or the wire or anything, because it's collectively, it's as a unit that this system has this insolvency. What you need is $200 billion worth of exit liquidity in order to essentially call that bill due. It's margin calling the leverage within the system itself. That is what's happening. How in the hell do you settle $200 billion of gold? And even more so, how do you do it in a matter of minutes or hours? How do you do it across countries? Like, let's say Russia and the US suddenly don't trust each other. So Russia wants their gold. They want to be settled from the US central bank. They don't want to be allocated to US debt anymore. How long does it take them to get $200 billion of gold? They just don't. They don't. They're going to send a bunch of battleships over like France did during 1971. That's a great example of what it costs to actually get that amount of gold securely, and the relative degree of frustration and difficulty that one has to go through. I mean, a lot of people don't realize this. France sailed a Navy cruiser into the New York Harbor with instructions, with orders to get their gold back from the New York Federal Reserve Bank. The reason that gold ended up the way it was because of the vast asymmetry, the imbalance between the huge amounts of time, the distance, and the huge cost in the scale of settling the value of gold. Part of it is mere cost in the sense that it costs more if you just wanted to measure in dollars how much does it cost to settle gold. Part of it is that, but it's not the important part. The cost is born in time, distance, and scale. The difference that, and it can't even be overcome. That's the thing. There's no solution. You can't just like pay $1 million and then you can have the gold settled instantly without any delay. like between Russia and the US. It's physically impossible. All you can do is pay more to reach the limits of what technology allows you to move that much weight that quickly, which I guess would be put it on a few different airlines and get it shipped across the world as fast as possible. The critical difference is the difference between the settlement of a physical good and a virtual good. That is what made gold fail in the way that it has. And think about it too, is that this settlement has to be ongoing, whereas virtual trade and payments do not stop. They don't like slow down because like, oh, we're waiting for the gold to settle. So as you're in the process of moving the gold, you've already, you know, shifted the balance of the debts before the gold even arrives. The difference in settlement of time is so great that commerce and exchange happens at such a pace that even when something is beginning to be cleared, it's no longer, the imbalance already, part of the imbalance is already growing again while still in the middle of the process of transmitting the gold to where it is owed. This imbalance does not and will not ever exist in Bitcoin because Bitcoin is a digital good to settle virtual and digital payments and credits. And the other two critically different factors is that it is entirely permissionless, entirely open, and it scales positively. The bigger it gets, the more value you are moving, the cheaper and faster it happens. When we're talking about on-chain, at least, when we're talking about having a UTXO. So go back to the scenario of a $1 trillion Bitcoin banking system, where 800 billion of it is fake. How long does it take to withdraw, to execute an exit of $200 billion from that system? If you have the permission to exit, then it's just 10 minutes. If they allow you to withdraw, and if they don't allow you to withdraw, then the whole thing just goes up in smoke because the credit instruments are not indistinguishable from Bitcoin. You can't make them look like the same thing. No matter what you do, Bitcoin is explicitly and entirely verifiable. The gold isn't even verifiable. You can't verify any of it. Oh man, that's actually another huge part of the cost I didn't even think about. Another huge difference is that you can't even verify the gold according to the substitutes. You're trusting the very nature, the very person who creates the substitutes to prove that they actually have the gold. But in the context of can you clear it out, it's kind of like in this world of APIs in banking, right? Is that if you can move from one bank to the other in a weekend, you know, you can make a bank insolvent. Like it was First Republic and Silicon Valley Bank. These things got drained by APIs just because they didn't have the cash on hand. So that's just moving money between banks to basically weed out the insolvency of any individual bank. But if you don't have something, but that's why it ends up actually aggregating all towards the largest banks, because then they don't have the relevant exit necessary to actually call their bluff. If you could actually do that in the reverse, if you could just withdraw from the banking system, then this whole thing would have collapsed. But you can't clear the $3 trillion imbalance or whatever it is to call the bluff, to basically margin call the insolvency, because that degree of exit just doesn't exist. But if you're talking about a $10 trillion Bitcoin market, if you're talking about Bitcoin being the underlying asset of the monetary system, you can clear $200 billion, you can clear $3 trillion of it in 10 minutes. In 10 minutes. It scales in value. It's just that you can't have 80% of the people exit in 10 minutes. And also take note that I am assuming nothing changes here, that we don't have any other improvements, that this doesn't end up having, you know, 1,000 people into each individual, like local fediments, and that you don't have CTV and all these things. Like, that's actually a crazy thing when you think about it, is that you could actually do all of the mechanism necessary to verifiably prove that every individual owns the relevant amount of Bitcoin, that force that verification, force essentially a proof of reserves, force a payment to which only the individual user can actually redeem that amount, and that the custodian or the bank or the financial service or whatever it is has no control over anymore. It is virtually and completely on-chain at that point, and they can do it for a billion people in a single UTXO, because they could just do a massive CTV drop. Now, it would take a decade probably to unravel that UTXO, but that's not the point. The point is that would prove one way or the other whether the institution was insolvent if that many people tried to withdraw to a CTV-based UTXO. And they actually could, quote-unquote, exit in that sense if that institution actually had the Bitcoin. If they don't, well, then their credit units, their substitutes for Bitcoin, become worthless in an instant. So when I suggested that Bitcoin has already proven this, that we have already seen what it looks like, this is exactly what happened with Mt. Gox. This is exactly what happened with FTX. The huge difference is in the time cost, the cost of moving value at scale, and the cost of being able to verify that that insolvency may be there even in the first place, and that the relevant networks are open and permissionless in the Bitcoin system, in the Bitcoin alternative. It means that distrusting governments in a Bitcoin world, distrusting governments, distrusting corporations, distrusting wealthy citizens in their jurisdiction, even average citizens and small, trust organizations and small federations. When trust starts to be threatened or begins to appear to break down and people get nervous, they can withdraw. And if there is an insolvency, if someone is faking Bitcoin substitutes, that will be uncovered between corporations, between banks, between countries, and it will happen in an extremely short period of time because you can settle $1 trillion in value in a single block on the Bitcoin network. There will always be, regardless of whether we even have the technology for the entire world to individually have essentially the exact same thing as on-chain, like individual UTXO sovereignty. Obviously, it wouldn't work like that. You'd never be able to scale the blockchain itself that big. But let's say that we could easily, or we had the technology to actually extend the degree of sovereignty that entails or suggests to the entire world, that everyone can be sovereign on Bitcoin. We would still mostly use Bitcoin substitutes. We simply will. And honestly, I think on a long enough timeline with the incentives in line and enough, of these iterative improvements and, new additions and new protocols, that we can essentially virtually reach that point where the whole world could be sovereign. But the whole world will not choose to do so. What we want is a big enough, permissionless, digital, stateless settlement system that, regardless of cost, is globally accessible and cannot be prevented from access. No one can be stopped from accessing it. And even if transaction costs are $100 a UTXO or $1,000 a UTXO, the scale of the imbalance, the scale of the insolvencies will never, the scale and duration will never reach even close to what gold has enabled. Because the critical failures of gold are literally based upon its physicality, not just some explicit cost, like some dollar fee in what it takes to get your gold settled. It is the inescapable reality and huge asymmetry between a virtually traded and a physically settled good. And most importantly, that no amount of cost can overcome. There is literally no dollar amount possible to pay to get, $1 trillion in gold sent from the U.S. to Russia in 10 minutes, irreversibly, without permission, without a third party, and verified completely and totally down to every last penny of value the second it ends up at its destination. That is not possible. Because it's a physical block of metal. With a Bitcoin network big enough, not only is it 100% possible, it's the default mode of operation. That's what it can do without any help whatsoever. And that is why it will not suffer the same fate as gold. There will be insolvencies. There will be imbalances. There will be paper Bitcoin not backed by Bitcoin. But there will not be a global monetary system that is insolvent at its foundation, in which money is lent out of thin air into existence, and there is no escape for the average person, and it builds up and gets worse and worse for 80, 90 years until the entire thing collapses. That will not be possible in a Bitcoin world. And every single institution or state that tries it, no matter how powerful they think they are, will only suffer the loss of total value of whatever note they claim is actually worth a Bitcoin. So in the short term, in the medium term, the ETFs are a massive social signal to Bitcoin being legitimized. It is a negative for the technical network. It is a negative for the sovereignty of the Bitcoin keys held. Because, of course, Coinbase is the custodian for like 60% of these, like 3/4 of them. I don't know. That is certainly not something that we want. But the larger the liquidity flow into the ETFs is, the greater that problem will be. And that does set us up for a short-term debt or deleveraging cycle, or the risk of some, you know, somebody hacks into Coinbase, man, they are going to be heavily, heavily rewarded. And unfortunately, people are stupid. We tend to only learn after we get burned. But if that plays out, it will likely play out pretty quickly. It will play out in 3 years, 5 years. If Coinbase starts selling paper Bitcoin, or one of these ETFs does, it will not take 80 years, and it will not be a civilization-destroying insolvency. Hell, just Bitcoin's volatility will tend to kind of keep that in check. But I think this is kind of one of those, we see two steps forward, one step back. This is the inevitable watering down of where Bitcoin touches the financial system, and it just means that, like the cypherpunks who never gave up on making digital money when the internet started to fail in the promises of the decentralized network, the better future that they saw, they didn't stop. And now we are watching those two steps forward, and we can already see where it will likely take one step back. And all that means is that we keep building. The cypherpunks kept that shit up for 30 years. If we gave up now, then it's totally our fault. We're the idiots and the cowards who didn't actually see this through. Well, that's not going to be me. So that is why I think Bitcoin does not become gold 2.0. All right. Thank you guys for listening. Thank you to CoinKite, the Cold Card Hardware Wallet, and to Swan Bitcoin for supporting this show. Do not forget that you can set up your DCA on Swan and auto withdraw to your Cold Card, and it will just run indefinitely. The links will be right there in the show notes. Do not forget to subscribe, rate this show on your podcast app, and share it out to everyone you know. It is a wonderful and amazingly free way to support this show, and I thank you greatly for those who do. I love you all. I am Guy Swan, and until next time, everybody, take it easy, guys. No man is brave that has never walked 100 miles. If you want to know the truth of who you are, walk until not a person knows your name. Travel is the great leveler, the great teacher. Bitter is medicine, crueler than mirror glass. A long stretch of road will teach you more about yourself than 100 years of quiet. Kvothe, From the Name of the Wind, written by Patrick Rothfuss.